My thing is just like, I don't, they can't, you know, they're asking us to trust them. They say youth is the answer. You know, we'll find the answers. Yet they had largely the same thing last year and didn't look
right
for large portions of the season. So, you know, they're basically saying we're going to do what we didn't do last year.
Well, that actually, you know what, that's exactly what they're saying. They're saying that a lot of guys are going to do what they didn't do last year. And
yeah. And we are going to, including us.
Right.
But we're also hoping that we don't, but what they're really hoping is that they do the same thing, you know?
Like, yeah.
They don't want to have to bench Dexter. They don't want to have to bench Harrison. They're hoping that doesn't happen.
Right.
But, you know, how long can they allow an offense to stink before they start looking for upgrades?
You know? Well, that answer is way different in a 60-game schedule.
Correct.
Than in a one.
You can make the case that it should be even faster, you know, but you could also make the case that the Cardinals might just say, well, you know, it's a 60-game season, so we'll just throw it out there and see what happens. I really don't know what they could use this as a way to drastically shake things up if they wanted to, but that would require them to show some flexibility they have not had.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week again by St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist Ben Fredrickson. And there is actually baseball activities, official baseball activities scheduled for Busch Stadium this week. That is part of why this podcast is belated. Apologies for that. There was a bit of news going on, and we wanted to make sure that we had kind of the full scope of the news and the agreement and players reporting and all that stuff before gathering together to discuss it. And also, we needed time to read the 113-page manual, which you got through, right? You did all your homework?
It was kind of like AP English in high school, Cliff Notes. I could write a couple paragraphs about them, but you wouldn't really want me to go full-on thesis. It was more of a skim read. But I think I got to the good parts. A lot of it was stuff we already knew, but there is some interesting things, some little tidbits in there that were pretty fascinating that I think, you know, hopefully players have a good sense of. The thing that I was most interested in is like the enforcement of things, because it's great to say, hey, everybody's going to do this. And then, you know, what happens when no one wants to? That's what I'm curious to see play out. But it sounds like they're going to be pretty strict about how they make people comply with some of these things.
With a few of them, you know, like fighting, right? And getting within 6 feet of the umpire. I mean, they're saying that they're going to have a hard line with that, that the teams will be facing suspension. You know, but less clear is like what's the penalty for having, you know, something on your, that wet rag you're allowed to carry in your back pocket. You know, there is no penalty if the runner on second in extra innings is the wrong guy. It's not considered batting out of order, for example. So, I mean, there are interesting elements there where it's sort of a metaphor, to be honest, for the agreement at large. Ben, is this notion that like things that can transmit the virus, or they think can transmit the virus, or bring people in close contact to one another, there are strict guidelines and strict penalties. But things that are more like, okay, this is about baseball, we're really going to trust you to just comply, thank you very much, kind of are more of a gentleman's agreement, if you will. And I think that really kind of captures what's going on here, is baseball is trying to do this huge undertaking, and it realize where it has to be strict and where it has to flex. This document, we joked that it was 113 pages, is going to be more than that by the time it's done. It's definitely a living document. You know, I talked to Andrew Miller a lot through this process, and he has insisted, you know, it's got to evolve. I think it actually, since you and I were able to read it, I think it has grown by a couple pages, to be honest. So, you know, they put these guidelines in place to definitely be strict and detailed and, you know, tight when it comes to how do you create a Ziploc bag that keeps the virus at much of a distance as possible from the game Whereas the things like within the game are a little bit more loose, you know, like no bat boys and bat girls, but you guys will figure out who's going to go get the bat and who's going to go get the donuts.
The thing that really struck me was there's going to attempt to be a emphasis on not only saying, hey, we have to do these things that are related to the virus for the sake of health and safety, but also for the sake of, there seems to be a mindfulness about the sake of appearances, right?
Right.
You know, we don't want to be, you know, putting something on TV that suggests, you know, that we're not taking this seriously. And that's what jumped out to me about the fighting thing, because we all heard, hey, no fighting. Well, there's not supposed to be fighting anyway. So what are you actually going to do to discourage it? Well, if they uphold the punishments that they've had in the past and they don't alter them or water them down based on the fact the season is 60 games, then that will be a deterrent in and of itself. I mean, if you get a 10-game suspension for a brawl, that's huge in this season. Mm-hmm. So that is something that I was actually curious. How are they going to do this? Well, there's one way. They say we're not going to adjust the punishments for, you know, things that break the rules based off the length of the games, which is, that should make you sit up in your seat a little bit if you get a fastball up and in and you feel like charging the mound.
Or if you plan on throwing a fastball up and in against, say, a team like maybe from Texas, like, you know, maybe down there.
Yeah, that's the Astros clause. The Astros are actually going to ask for the 2020 rules to apply indefinitely. I mean, they just want no fans, no fans in the stands on away games, no fighting allowed.
They want
everybody on that roster phases out, and then they can go back to normal.
Yeah, they want the prorated suspensions based on a 162. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like a 15 game penalty or suspension is three out of what, maybe, you know, 10 starts a starter might get. I mean, that's a substantial chunk. So you read through the manual and you were all giving thought to this question of how likely is a season. Like, you read through it, you see people going through the entry screening right now. The official report date is July 1st. That's set up because that allows for 24 to 48 hours of self-isolation, quarantine, while you wait for the result of the test. The players or the Cardinals have some people reporting on July 1st. They've had a lot of folks come in earlier. They're going to have their first staggered workout on Friday, July 3rd. But there'll be some informal workouts before that for people who have cleared the test. Late Monday night, they found out that they had their first positive exam. So now they're going through the protocol spelled out in the 113-page manual, the operations manual, as we should call it. And, you know, so, and other teams are going to do the same. Just by more testing, you're going to have more positive tests. So what do you think is the feasibility of this season? That's the big question, right?
You know, it is a big one. And, you know, it's ironic that you ask it, because about 15 minutes before we started recording this podcast, I was online shopping for a few masks that I can have in my bag for going to the ballpark. I've been wearing them when I go out, but I've got, you know, like, I'll be honest, they're a little cheesy. They're either the really cheap ones, or they're goofy. They have like turtles, sea turtles on them. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to make an investment in like a decent looking mask. And I'm like, how bizarre is this? Like, usually when we prepare for spring training, we're like, oh, let's go get fresh notebooks and pens, and like, let's, you know, clean out our book bags and our whatever, you know, computer bags we take down, and make sure that's kind of getting ready for a spring training. And now it's in July almost, and we're shopping for masks on the internet. It's like, what are we doing here? But, you know, and that's the big question. I've officially, I guess, taken the stance on betting the under when it comes to pulling this off. And I hope I'm wrong. Look, I mean, I think we should all be candid here. I get tired of seeing people say, well, you keep writing about the virus, and, you know, it's like sports writers don't want a season to happen. Well, I can tell you they do, at least, you know, 99% of them, considering that, you know, without sports to cover, then we're all going to feel this in terms of our jobs. And we already have, I mean, with the problems newspapers have encountered during this time. So it's it does me no good to say this, but I'm skeptical. I think John Mozeliak did a great job of kind of laying it out when we had that Zoom with him a while back where he said, you know, they feel pretty good about how they can protect people at the ballpark, but there's a significant risk in what happens away from the ballpark. And, you know, that's everybody's life, right? We're all making decisions about what is okay, what is not okay. We all have different lines, but, you know, it is challenging to take the playing force that is Major League Baseball, and also, you know, everybody who has to be in that tier one and tier two, and tell them that their decisions away from the ballpark are going to, you know, really determine whether or not there's a season. I mean, these guys tend to be young. They tend to be, you know, of that mindset where they're going to be fine. And for the most part, what we know about the virus, most of them will be fine if they come in contact with coronavirus. However, we don't know that we can't guarantee that everybody will. Not everybody in that group is that healthy, you know, young age. There's managers and coaches and things of that nature. A lot of people have to be involved who we got to think about. And the other thing too is, and no one talks about this. All I hear is people saying, well, you know, these guys are healthy, they'll be fine. Or this is a terrible idea, it shouldn't happen. More interesting is the conversation in the middle that's saying, hey, these guys probably won't die, you know, from the coronavirus. But what no one is really talking about is A, what happens if someone does, but the other one is, what are the long-term effects of this that maybe aren't as known now because nobody knows? And the other one is, you know, people say, well, if they miss 2 weeks and they come back, then it'll be fine. They'll cycle in and cycle out. I think people underestimate what 2 weeks or 3 weeks or four can do to a professional athlete if they're not training, having the right nutrition, practicing. These things add up quickly, especially in a 60-game season. So the more guys you have cycling out, every time someone leaves for that period of time, the more watered down the product gets. So, yeah, you could probably get through 30 games or through 60 games with 60 players, a 60-player pool, which is what you're going to have between, you know, the two camps. But it doesn't mean the quality is going to be very good. And at some point, the conversation will turn from, hey, is this worth it? Especially as we're seeing the cases, you know, increase in different parts of the country. It seems like sports are trying to launch while we're having this problem with, you know, a rising problem with case numbers. So it's not just about the numbers. It's not just about the number of deaths. It's about how this affects the game and how it's going to affect athletes who are, you know, at the top of their game. That's a huge part of this that no one really seems to be discussing.
Yeah, I mean, the long-term effects, I've been asking a few experts about that, but one of the things is, you know, it's actually in the definition of the phrase why they don't yet have an answer, right, is what are the long-term effects of this? And they don't know because it hasn't been a long-term study. Players have brought that up, you know, questions about their families, about what they're bringing back, you know, risks like that. I think, you know, there are a lot of layers to this that, you know, during a radio interview earlier today, somebody asked me about Buster Olney's comment. Actually, I've been asked multiple times about Buster Olney's comment that he doesn't think that there's much of a percent chance at all of a season getting up. And at one point put it at zero. And I was asked why the negativity. And the answer I gave was, well, it's math. I mean, that's what it is it's exactly as you outlined. It's the more tests happen, the more positive tests they'll find. There are players that are going to go through this entry screening that have gone through no screening, may have had, are probably asymptomatic, have not had any problems, and are going to learn that, oh, you have the active virus right now, quarantine, go and move on from there. And then at what point in time does, you know, that start cutting into exactly as you described, the number of games they can play, how they recover, how they feel, how proactive do they have to be to keep it from spreading to all the groups you discussed, including the friends and family of their fellow teammates. It's going to be interesting, and there's going to be some really probably strong and, well, there has to be. There are team meetings. You know, I think that's an interesting part of the operations manual, is it outlines how there has to be a code of conduct settled on by a team, and a team is going to have to do that individually. And, you know, in the Cardinals case, they're going to lean on their veteran players and some of the young players with strong opinions to help set that. And what that all means and why I think it's important, I'm going to ask you about, Ben, but first I got to tell people about our sponsor, and that's Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design, that's 314-733-9855. Closets by Design, the official sponsor of the weekly best podcast in baseball, 314-733-9855. 9855. I think, Ben, that like this is such a remarkable undertaking by a 2,200 person beast moving around the country, that to pull this off is going to take such a level of discipline and, you know, devotion and commitment that it could be a remarkable feat of the baseball community. I mean, it has that in there, right? Like, it could be a remarkable event of human cooperation if they pull it off. If you want optimism, there it is. That's the optimism, is that if they're able to pull this off, consider how many people had to work together and change their habits and change their practices and stay disciplined to a cause, and that cause is a baseball season, to pull it off.
That's a great way of phrasing it. I mean, we don't have to say, oh, there's no way in hell it's going to work. We can say, hey, it's going to take a gargantuan task to make this work. And it's going to take full cooperation by all involved. And the thing that you got to remember is it's not, hey, someone tested positive, shut it down. But this is a rolling conversation about how, you know, basically, you know, at what point does, if it's a Venn diagram, at what point does the coronavirus circle get so big the baseball circle is smaller? And that's what every business is doing right now. And baseball is a massive one under a very public spotlight. And mm-hmm. that is going to be involved with pressure from politicians, pressure from media, pressure from fans, pressure from players. I mean, there's a lot of voices in this room. And then you throw in the fact that while we all love baseball, you know, and it's a huge part of our jobs to cover this game, you know, there's a conversation going on about what is absolutely essential and what is not. Baseball's trying to be a part of this. Hey, we need to give people something to cheer about, to be excited about. And that's been its role in history over the time. So it will have many people saying this needs to progress. But if it gets significant friction, if it has significant problems, then I think the conversation could shift. You know, that's going to be, you know, there's going to be, you mentioned the growing operations manual. This conversation is going to grow. What's going to happen if some of these cities that are having more trouble with the virus now are all of a sudden supposed to open and host games? I mean, there's a reason, right. Like on the hockey side of thing, there's a reason they keep delaying the announcing where these hub cities are going to be for their playoffs, because the landscape keeps changing. You know, they don't want to plant a flag and then have to move it because that's a sign of a loss. So they're delaying. And I think there's going to be some of that involved here too. And it's kind of this notion about bringing fans back. It's easy to say, yeah, we're going to try to, but what does that actually mean? It can change a week from now. So, you know, I like the plan that they put out. I think it makes, when you read it, it makes a lot of sense the way they're going to try to contain this. But again, it's going to take full cooperation on all levels in order to keep the virus from really becoming a distraction, a bigger distraction than it already is.
What's your critical mass, do you think? What's the number where it becomes so diluted that it's not competitive? I mean, in the past 24 to 48 hours, Ryan Zimmerman of the Washington Nationals, Joe Ross of the Washington Nationals have bowed out. Mike Leake of the Arizona Diamondbacks, he also chose not to play. Ian Desmond, in a moving explanation,
That was amazing.
Going to get a lot of attention in baseball, and we'll discuss that. I'll pull it up to read here later for people. But he opts out and says that he'll be spending this time putting back into the Little League that helped make him who he is, which I thought was just a profound statement among many that he made. So you have some star players, you have some, you know, key players. Arizona's lost a member of its starting rotation. Is it a star player that bows out that makes this season unfeasible? Is it a number of players on each team? Is it the first time a team doesn't have its varsity starting rotation that we start to question the integrity of the season?
Well, I think if you want to question the integrity of the season, you can start now. 60-game season, we can start there. You know, but to me, it's like if you're playing a game with the, with teams that, that lack any recognizable players. And I know that's a bit, that's a different needle point for anybody. I mean, some people can't name any players. Everybody knows all the prospects. But, you know, if the average fan looks at the team and goes, who? Then what are we, you know, what's the point of this? And I don't know that you say, hey, guys are opting out. We got to stop. But to me, it would be if the virus takes away a starting infield, you know, then I don't know. Then really, what are we talking about with the season here? You know, if your 1 through 5 hitters are not available because they're all in different stages of quarantine, then I'm not sure a 60 game season is gonna be very meaningful. And that's the thing too, is okay, if the guy's gone, if you're out, if you're pulled out of the equation, whether, you know, you're probably going to have your season significantly marred, whether you're sick or not. And by sick, I mean whether you're feeling the effects of the virus or whether you're asymptomatic. You know, it's good news that a lot of people who are testing positive are asymptomatic. It's hard because it makes it, if you're not getting regular testing, it means you're probably spreading it. But, you know, the number of people who are asymptomatic is good. And then that should be said, hey, it means it's not really giving that many folks that many severe effects. We obviously know the more at-risk population. But still, if you're an asymptomatic player who's plucked from the group and you've got to spend time away from the game until you can meet whatever requirements, you know, the 2 tests that say you can come back, that's still going to affect you. Now you're going to throw in, what if you are sick? Yeah. Okay, so you're not on your deathbed, maybe with a ventilator. God, I hope no one gets to that point. But even if you're in that, even if you're just ill, you know, there have been people who have gotten this thing who don't feel right 3, 4, 5 weeks after the fact. They don't have the virus anymore. They're not contagious, but they just don't feel right. You know, and that's people who go to work and sit down at a computer. So, you know, imagine that if you're a pitcher. Imagine that if you're a hitter. So I think when it becomes, when lineups start to become unrecognizable, you got a big problem. The other thing too is, if somebody gets drastically ill, then I think the conversation could shift. If a manager of an older at risk manager, you know, all of a sudden is on a ventilator, then we've got to stop and go, okay, is this worth it? I don't want to be the person who has to make the decision of how many people can die for baseball to happen. I feel the same way about college sports, and that's even a more tricky situation because those guys aren't employees. They don't have a union to negotiate the terms of their return. Baseball, they're professional athletes. They have made their decision. They have an ability to not play if they decide to do that. And if they have a reason health-wise, physically, then they can get paid. I think that's a great plan. So I'm okay with baseball trying to figure this out, but we all have to acknowledge that there's a real downside here. And while the risks of it are slim, it could be a conversation that nobody in the game wants to have if they're all of a sudden faced with someone that is vital to their game being in a critical state of health because they push forward. Again, complicated because there's no guarantee that they would have not gotten that if there wouldn't have been a season. You know, you can get this thing at 7-Eleven, you can get it at church, you can get it wherever you're going. You know, whether it's a protest or a parade, it doesn't matter. The virus doesn't care. So, you know, it's a little disingenuous to say, well, they've got it because baseball's happening. Baseball's probably, the stadium is probably the safest place for these guys to be with all the testing that's going to be involved. But
and all the cleaning. The
traveling and the things that it requires, that's where it gets a little hazy. Are they more at risk because they're doing those things compared to they would be staying at home? That's if they're staying at home. Some of these guys aren't staying at home, Derek. Some of these guys are going to birthday parties. Some of these guys are going to the bars. I mean, that's the problem here is that everybody's got their own views of how serious this is.
Well, and that brings us back to like the code of conduct that the group is going to have to settle on. On the road, there are very distinct rules. I was really struck by that in the operations manual, that on the road, it is very spelled out on what the traveling party can and cannot do. You know, this notion that you can't go to restaurants, you can't go where the public, where their public gathers. You cannot go to a restaurant if it's in the same hotel. No bars, all that stuff. On the road, it's spelled out very clearly for the entire traveling party, not just players, but anyone who is on the traveling party. That includes what will what people will become more familiar with in the tier two and tier one elements, which are essential personnel, players, and then also people in direct contact with the players. So that's like, you know, clubhouse attendance, media relations, general managers, owner is, would be a tier two, that kind of thing. So, you know, I think it's really interesting how that's spelled out very clearly, but how the players wanted to police themselves when it comes to their home and returning home and what they do in their home city, because not all home cities are created equal. And so you bring, you know, it brings us back to that point where, you know, it's going to take, you know, the collective of a team, you know, buying into this. And I've talked to a few players and I've seen comments from other teams as well. And, you know, baseball players by nature, professional athletes by nature, a lot of us by nature are competitive. And so they'll make it a competition. You know, who can stay healthiest, who the team that stays healthiest might be the best team if they let this go. Are you comfortable with the commissioner holding the power of determining when the game is too diluted and it has to stop?
Well, I mean, certainly under his job description, I don't Absolutely. Think we shouldn't be uncomfortable with a commissioner holding that decision. However, with this commissioner, I don't know that anyone can trust that it will be made with the best intentions. That's and Rob Manfred has opened himself up to having his credibility questioned as much as anybody cares to who's followed what he said and then waffled on. I mean, he's made some really dumb decisions, and this is outside of the negotiations, and we get that's a negotiating tactic. But just say things publicly and then immediately say, "Well, I've changed my mind about that." You've eroded your faith, the faith that you have in people who care about the game. You know, to say there's 100% going to be a season, turn around the next day and say, "Well, I'm not so sure about that." I mean, his words matter. And I think he uses them sometimes as a master negotiator and a great lawyer. But I think what sometimes he fails to see is that his words mean more than that now. They mean the caretaker of baseball. And he has shown no interest in, you know, occupying that part of his job description that is really set aside to be above and beyond the guarding of the game. He's the guardian of the owners. He's the guy, the shield for the owners, the spear point for the owners. And he's very good at that. But he doesn't seem to want to, you know, ever go to that other place. So when you're talking about him having the ability to say, "Hey, we can't do this," then I think the problem is he's so much owner based and so little baseball based that I think people are going to question that he's looking for a way to do it. Flip side, if it grinds through some pretty gnarly stuff, then it will be that he doesn't care about the players. He can't win, and I feel bad for him to some degree, but he's put himself in this position.
Well, it's the best interest of baseball clause. That's where the power comes from. But you're right. I mean, it's an interesting spot for everybody, but it speaks to the fact that, like, if this goes awry, it will be interesting to see what that does for Manfred's position as commissioner, Manfred's legacy for sure, how owners view him and how players view him on the cusp of another CBA negotiation. You know, all of that is prelude to, and the discussion we just had are all the big issues. And then there are also the wonderful, trivial baseball issues that we used to agonize over and gnash our teeth over back in March in Jupiter. You know, this week, Ben, you know, if baseball gets to its first workout, and it looks like it will, we'll be able to watch official Cardinal baseball for the first time since 4 days before St. Patrick's Day. So, which obviously is a cultural, you know, eon ago. What are you going to be looking for? What are some of the things like on the field that you are going to watch as they get ready for a 21-day mad dash for opening day?
Well, I think the main thing will be, hey, who's going to be snagged by the inevitable yet unfortunate you know, elephant in the room here. A, one, being health with coronavirus, you know, there will probably be, I wouldn't be surprised if there are guys who are not out there right away because they've tested positive from the initial, you know, kind of onboarding. You had the report that one person in the organization has. We're going to see this across baseball. This is what happens when you bring a bunch of people who've been all over the country and some outside of the country together. So who's available, I think, is the main thing. And then the other one is beyond COVID, who's healthy. There's going to be, I think, some hiccups here, dead arms, you know, ligament issues. I mean, things of that nature. This is baseball.
Soft
such
tissue,
a
hamstrings.
Totally. Baseball is such a schedule oriented beast. And there's so much routine involved. This has completely shaken that up. So I think you're going to see some of that, which will probably, you know, dictate who's available right away to begin with. Beyond that, I think that's really what you're watching for. There's not going to be, I don't think, someone who has such a bad or great summer training performance that it changes the Cardinals' plans of what they're going to do when game one rolls around. Now, I think that's going to be built mostly based on health. So who's available is going to be the big question.
Are you at all intrigued by how they sort out the pitching too and what kind of numbers they go with there?
Yes. I've said this. I would like to see them just make it very simple and do a six-man rotation as long as everybody's available, as long as those guys are good to go. To me, you know, give six guys 10 starts apiece. And the reason you do that is because if something happens, then you're – a little more, you know, well-braced for having to go down to five or just keeping it at six with all the guys they already have who could be a starter. I mean, they have so many arms. I think finding a way to tap into as many as they can is a strength for them. The Cardinals are better positioned than probably any other team, wouldn't you say? Or if not tied for first, for inevitably some of these pitching hiccups that are going to come about. They don't have a minor league season to get guys reps. So they would be behooved to create opportunities for some of these guys to have something to work toward to, you know, further their development, but also doing it in a way that can help them competitively too. Mozeliak has talked a lot about that balancing between development and competitiveness, but I think there's a place where the Cardinals can get where they're doing both, where developing guys in certain settings is helping their competitiveness. I think they have the pitching depth to be able to do that. But I think one way you start is by saying, hey, we're not going to, you know, throw one of these guys to the pen just to have the traditional five-man rotation. We're going to, in a crazy season where everything is changing, we're going to show some change and we're going to go with six.
Yeah, well, that would be adding a healthy Miles Michaelis to the five that we're going to start the season with Gungyung Kim as the fifth starter after, you know, he pitched so well in one of those final games of spring training and has such a different look. You figure that when you're making a short list of guys who will be helped by a short season, man, his newness and what he's able to do and how little time and how little opportunity teams are going to have to adjust to him, that's going to be a fascinating element. I think it's also an interesting element of the schedule, correct? Like the Cardinals could end up, if they win the NL Central, or anybody who wins the NL Central, could end up in the first round facing a National League team that hasn't seen them all year and yet then could face a team in the World Series that they did face multiple times during the year because of the way the schedule's set up. So I think that's an interesting element for some of the newness of these guys, particularly pitchers and particularly Gungyung Kim, with just, I mean, it's going to be tricky for teams to adjust to them and they'll have no chance, no time in a short series or in some of these like one-off series. They're just going to see him, be uncomfortable, and then see in 2021. So I find that part fascinating. The Cardinals could get significantly creative, too, with their pitching. I mean, I think, you know, with Schilt and Mike Maddux and, you know, help from the analytics department and guidance from the front office, I mean, they're looking at the possibility of getting really creative with buy-in from the pitchers. Now, there are going to be some pitchers who still define themselves by how deep into the game and what kind of quality start they give, but they may be asked, you know, hey, look, we can do something different here, especially to start with the added roster where, you know, get two times through the lineup, get that group through, you know, four or five innings, and then turn it over to guys like Ponce de Leon, turn it over to guys like, Yenesis Cabrera, turn it over to guys like Alex Reyes, turn it over to guys like Austin Gomber. And I think if you just line up just, and I'm not suggesting that they do this, but just think about like the way they could present this, Ben, in the sense that like you could go from Jack Flaherty with his stuff from the right side to then having Austin Gomber come in with his very different look from the left side. You could have Adam Wainwright up there pitching backwards with his curveball, fastball, and then come at that same lineup, you know, this third time through with Yenesis Cabrera with 98 from the left side. You could go Dakota Hudson with his power sinker located in the lower part of the zone for four innings, then come back with Daniel Ponce de Leon and his elevated high spin rate fastball for another three innings. I mean, you could just offset the looks so often that it becomes like and have the depth to pull it off over a 60-game schedule. It would be really difficult to see them do that for a full season, but to have what would effectively be three Octobers in a row would be, I think the Cardinals are well situated for that. They certainly have the best depth in the division, and I'm eager to see just how inventive they get to utilize it.
Just suffocate teams with an assortment of pitching. I mean, take the Reds lineup and make that your and roll out the kryptonite with just the, as imposing of a lineup of pitchers, right? But that to me is like,
I'm going
to
use that line. I'm going to steal that line. You ready for that? I'm totally stealing that line. I've said it here on the podcast. You're going to read that in one of my articles. I'm totally taking it.
I like this idea, and this is, I'm glad occasionally I can give you something since I take many of your lines. So it's a fair trade here. I think what I'm most interested, I tried to write about this for a column in the paper. We're recording this on a Tuesday, so it was in today's. But this is the most fascinating thing about this Cardinal season to me. And outside of the obvious, you know, things we've talked about with the COVID and everything, is how the Cardinals really are able to change their stride, because they are, by definition, an ultra marathon team. They are built for 162. They make decisions based off of 162 and not trying to win an off season or not trying to win a trade deadline. They're built for the long haul. They're beyond that. They're built for the long haul of seasons. I mean, their annual competitiveness is historic, and they are in this crazy spot where they have their fan base that totally appreciates their sustained success, but they're also like the fans that watch the sprinter and go, or the long distance runner and wonder why he can't just run a little bit faster at times, but you know, he always likes where he is around the pack at the end. Sometimes even in first, but this is really, we're going to see what happens when a long distance team is thrust into a mile race. And, you know, that's fascinating. Is what do they do? Do they keep their pace and say, well, this isn't our race? Or do they say, we're going to have to evolve and we might have some aches and pains, but we're going to try to take what we have and reorganize our strengths to win what has become a drastically shortened season. And I don't mean that in terms of, hey, go nuts, you know, go sign, you know, Puig, go trade for Arenado. I just mean in terms of aggressively, you know, organizing the guys you have. I mean, that comes down to how many times does a struggling player get an opportunity before there's an answer sought from within? How many times does the lineup roll out before it's changed? How many unimpressive starts does an entrenched starter get before there's a new arm in there? All of these things, we've talked a lot in the past about like weaponizing the Cardinals' depth. There's never been a better season to do that, because in part, there should be a sense of freedom to this season. If you try something and it doesn't work, it's a weird, wonky season anyway. There shouldn't be this pressure of, oh, we've always done things this way. It should be a time to get weird and then see how it can answer some things for you moving forward on top of that.
I think that's a good motto for the season. Let's get weird. Let's stay get healthy. Weird. Maybe not that
one. Stay healthy. Stay healthy.
Stay healthy. Get weird. That's the bumper sticker right there. Stay healthy. Get weird. You know, the decisions that they make along the way is ultimately going to be driven by how much value they put on winning a championship this season versus how this season sets up for next. I was asked in the chat, you know, will this season actually give them enough time to make some of the choices that they have for the season, for the years ahead? And it's like, no, of course not. But it's all they got. This is all they got. This is all any team has. And so 60 games is better than 30 games. 30 games is better than 0 games. It's not ideal as a full minor league season. And some of the instructional league and some of the, you know, constant, you know, groundhog days that are ahead for the group at Springfield, it's just, it's not ideal, but that's all they got. And so they got to make decisions in that regard. The, you know, the overarching question, though, is what kind of decisions are you going to make for a championship that carries the numbers 2020 on it? You hear different things on that. You know, Dave Ross says if there's a title to be won, the Cubs want to win it. You know, the Dodgers have some interesting thoughts on, you know, how much they've invested in this year and this being the end, you know, or maybe, you know, the peak year of their chances to win after what, 7 consecutive NL West divisions. Now they're now they have Mookie Betts and now they're facing a shortened season that is always going to have the, you know, 2020 on it. So, you know, I asked Mo Zalok about that. This notion that, like, well, your Cardinals brand is that they contend no matter what, and they are perennial contenders and they're out to win a championship. Does this season leave you questioning that? Does this season leave you modifying that at all? And his answer was no. You know, if there's games and titles to be won, then you go out to win it. But I think their actions are always going to speak louder than words, always do. And particularly this year, do you Ben buy into this notion that, if there's a championship to be had, then do all you can to win it? Or does this come with a little different feel?
Well, I think that's always what everyone in that spot is going to say. It's kind of like a college football coach on signing day. I've yet to hear one who comes out and say, well, we didn't really get the players we wanted. So, you know, we're going to try to make the best of it. No, they say we got everybody we wanted and this was the best day we could have had. Everyone right now at 0 of 60 games is going to say, hey, we're in this thing to win it. And we're this championship matters. Now, my personal belief is that the championship does matter. I'm not someone who thinks, well, if it's not 162 games, it doesn't matter. To me, the uniqueness of this season makes that almost would make winning it more impressive. What are you going to have to do to win it? You're going to have to keep your guys healthy. You're going to have to, you know, really change the way that baseball has been played for a large degree, embrace new rules in a time of great stress for an organization. That to me would be a championship that I would look back and go, man, do you remember the year that baseball almost didn't happen and the entire country really looked to the sport for entertainment and that team that came out and won it? I mean, there's you can make a case that this could be, you know, a more relevant championship than some of the ones that will bookend it. I think that case can be made, and I believe that. So yeah, I think they should say it matters. Now, again, the actions will tell us. If 30 teams are sellers at the trade deadline and no one's buying, then we're going to get an answer. If we see players who, you know, I thought, you know, the description Matt Carpenter gave you, I thought was very good. And thank you for letting me use it for a column. But he talked about, hey, you know, when a guy's, you know, just hitting into some tough spots and you can tell when he's not right. Teams that continue to give opportunities to players who are not right, when there could be a better option in-house because of contract politics or just being stuck in tradition, whatever, they can't really say that they're in it to win it 100%. You know, we're going to see by teams' actions. That's going to be the fascinating part of the season. We're going to see pretty clearly who it matters to. And I think it won't just be in the games they win, but it will be in how they go about trying to win them.
Which brings us to the question, and I really think you made such a good point about how maybe this championship shines a little brighter because of what it means they went through to get it. I think that's a great point. We can't talk about how much teams have to unify and how much the game has to come together to cooperate without then also acknowledging that maybe that adds some additional glisten to the piece of metal that they'll win at the end of it. I mean, I think that's a great point.
What does Manfred call it? That hunk of metal?
Piece of metal.
Oh, yeah.
Piece of metal. Yeah. I was making the right reference there. I was pulling the
what were we saying about you know, there being some concerns that maybe he doesn't you know, value his role as gatekeeper and guardian of the game. It's comments like that that make you question.
Well, when the award is named after your position and you call it a piece of metal, it's a little bit. Yeah, I get it. But that does bring us to the question probably on a lot of Cardinal fans' mind, and one that's on the Cardinals as well, is what to do with Dylan Carlson. You know, they've said very openly and honestly and repeatedly for the last 12 months that Tyler O'Neill, Lane Thomas, and that group is going to get a crack at left field, and that while Dylan Carlson is part of their outfield of the future, he doesn't, you know, they're going to give a chance for other people to be part of the outfield of the now. That could change 8 games in, because all of a sudden now you've extended control of Dylan Carlson and his service time for another season. And I get that fans want him there from opening day, but don't you also want a team that makes a choice that 162 game season of one of the best players that you expect coming along is more important than 8 games? I understand that it's not right, and I know service time manipulation and massaging is not really, it feels wrong, and it feels like something that should be addressed, and I know that teams can't admit to doing it because then there'll be a grievance and yada, yada, yada. But, don't you want a team that makes that decision, though, that prioritizes what could be a full season in the future, what should be a full season in the future, versus 8 days of a 60-game season?
Well,
9 days.
Those 8 games are equivalent to, what, 22 games? You know, so I think if we're going to do it that we have, if we're going to argue about, you know, discuss whether the 60 game season matters, then we I think it's important to try to keep into perspective the value of each game. I mean, we're looking at each game being relatively worth 2.5 to, you know, to 3 games.
So in the standings, but not in revenue, not in,
no, I,
you know,
I
service
know, but,
time,
but,
not
see,
reality.
That's the conversation, though, is does the, and does the 2020 championship matter because of the championship, or does it matter because of all the benefits that would come with it? I mean, you can see where those lines clash. Now, this would be an easier, you know, criticism of the Cardinals if we were all guaranteed that Dylan Carlson would start that season and be the best outfielder available. You can make the case that he might be, but, and you could, you know, make the case that he will be, but I don't know that anybody knows for sure, whether it's the Cardinals or us or anybody who wants to see Dylan Carlson play, that's absolutely the case.
Interesting.
It's funny to me, and the Cardinals have done a good job of this. They're pitching this as, hey, it can't be, you know, the reason that we're going to slow play Dylan Carlson, and at least until, you know, this service time thing goes away a little bit. The reason we'll do it is because, you know, it's unfair to say we're going to give opportunities to Tyler O'Neill and Lane Thomas and then not do it. And, you know, that, okay, you can see where that makes sense. These guys haven't had a chance, but what the Cardinals are saying by saying that is that, you know, it's almost as if, hey, let's not talk about the center fielder and the right fielder, two guys that didn't have, you know, good offensive seasons last year compared to players in that position on other teams in the average. I mean, the Cardinals, this all comes down to offense. The Cardinals were a team that really dragged a deficient offense all the way to baseball's Final Four last season. And they can say that because they prioritized defense and pitching, they got further than any other, you know, National League team not named the Nationals. And that's true. But the question that remains is, could they have won it all? Could they have beaten the Nationals and gone to the World Series if they would have done more to try to create an offense that didn't hold the team back, you know, during the regular season and also in the postseason? One of the ways it could have done that would have been creating more opportunities for Lane Thomas before he got hurt, and Tyler O'Neill potentially last season. One of the opportunities could have been rushing Dylan Carlson there last season, or making some sort of an addition at the trade deadline, which they didn't do. So that conversation has just stayed. And now what the Cardinals are saying, well, we've got to create these opportunities, and we can't, you know, we can't give a new guy opportunity before newish guys have not had full ones. And I think it's okay to step back from that and say, okay, maybe the answer could be creating more opportunities for the newish guys and the new guy. And I think that to me is the fascinating thing. It's not when does Dylan Carlson jump ahead of Lane Thomas and Tyler O'Neill. It's when do the Cardinals feel like, you know, if they don't get the performance from Bader and Fowler that they need, that they're willing to open up those spots. Now, that's the question, is when does that, you know, in a 60-game season, when does an underperforming established player start to become questioned in terms of being, you know, moved? That doesn't have to just be Bader or Fowler. It could be Matt Carpenter. And Carpenter's been right, as candid about this as anybody. He said, I show up to spring training having to earn my spot. And he really believes that. So that to me is the question for Shildt, is like, and Shildt and Mo, is when do they say, okay, you know, under the pressure of this game where each game is like three, then how long can we give a player who's not performing? Now, if all these guys show up and mash and they're playing well and they're winning, then the thing gets delayed and maybe it goes away. That's what the Cardinals would like to see. They would like to see there not be a need for Dylan Carlson until this service time discussion goes away. And I don't think we'll see him until it goes away. But if they're losing and they're not getting production from the outfield during that time, then it's going to be criticism and a fair one.
Yeah. No, and you're right. It's more a question of the outfield as a group than it is left field. And I hope that I do well not to always present it that way, because –
No, you did a good job of it. It is, and I can see why Mo's presenting it that way, because it's a strong argument if you keep the blinders on. But I think the thing isn't just left field, it's the outfield as a whole. That was the group that underperformed last year. It wasn't just one guy in it. It was the group
as a
whole.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. And you know, that's part of it. So Dylan Carlson's on your opening day roster then, if you're GM BF?
Oh no.
No, because you're making a business decision.
Yeah, but I'm not gonna. But I'm also, you know, I'm going to have him up very. I'm gonna have him up probably the day after if the guys aren't playing. I mean, that's the
part of. I think you don't know what he's gonna do though.
I think you give the guys that you've committed to a shot, but if it's, I'm not gonna go 30 games watching the same stuff I watched last year. You know, if it's a week and a half into the season and Harrison Bader is still taking the same at-bats that made him, you know, the lowest producing OPS player that got more than 300 at-bats last year, then I'm making a change. And I'm making a change because I've told my fans and I've operated this off season and this spring with the idea that answers are within, and that, you know, that this team is going to get better from within. So if I'm seeing signs, more struggles are the same, then I'm not waiting. If Matt Carpenter is the guy that he was last season, then I'm not gonna feel bad about putting, you know, Tommy Edman in that spot. I think the season gives you the freedom to make changes that are for here and now, and then see how the pieces fall out when you start to go back to that 162 game discussion. But will the Cardinals operate with that intent, or will this be more about, hey, you know, the way they played it in the past has been, hey, we've committed to this guy, we're going to give him the chances. And there's examples of that working, and there's examples of that not working. But, you know, continuing to give chances without testing what you don't know, this is probably not going to be a good year to do that.
Some players are having to make individual choices too on whether or not they want to play. And one player who made that choice and then wrote this rather profound and lengthy post on Instagram that details why he made that decision is Ian Desmond of the Colorado Rockies. He's at I_DEZ20. And in this post on Instagram, he talks about revisiting the little league fields of his youth and thinking about baseball and talking about somebody who was very influential in the little leagues there of Sarasota, Florida. And he mentions it this way, and he's building up to revealing his decision on not playing in 2020 and why. And he writes this. He says, right now in baseball, we've got a labor war. We've got rampant individualism on the field. In clubhouses, we've got racist, sexist, homophobic jokes, or flat out problems. We've got cheating. We've got a minority issue from the top down. One African-American GM, two African-American managers, less than 8% black players, no black majority team owners. Perhaps most disheartening of all is a puzzling lack of focus on understanding how to change those numbers. If baseball is America's pastime, maybe it's never been more fitting one than now. And he goes on for a while here to describe other, you know, other elements of what he sees, and then arrives at this decision to not play the 2020 season, but to be involved in baseball in another way in 2020. And that he says he's going to be more involved in the little league of his area. And he concludes by saying, "The COVID-19 pandemic has made this baseball season one that is a risk I am not comfortable taking. But that doesn't mean I'm leaving baseball behind for the year. I'm right here at my old little league, and I'm working with everyone involved to make sure we get Sarasota youth baseball back on track. It's what I can do in the scheme of so much. So I am. With a pregnant wife and four young children who have lots of questions about what's going on in the world, home is where I need to be right now. Home for my wife, Chelsea, home to help, home to guide, home to answer my older three boys' questions about coronavirus and civil rights and life. Home to be their dad." I mean, it's a powerful statement that pulls back, opens the doors on a clubhouse culture that refocuses the conversation. And then like almost spells out an individual's action plans for taking a year to reset himself and commit to the game in a different way. I was really moved by this, very thoughtful. And I urge people to go read it. And in doing so, Ben, it really brought up the crux, the bigger question of not just how does baseball pull this off, but Ben, is it worth it? Is it worth all this to pull it off?
I was mad at Ian Desmond. Not because of anything he said. He was brilliant, I read it this morning and my jaw was open. It was just beautiful. I'm always mad when people who don't write for a living can write something like that. Because it's like, it's hard to write, okay? And I tell people it's hard, and then they're like, they see a professional baseball player who's excellent, you know, excellent enough at baseball to be one of the few people who get a chance to play professionally, turn around and write something like that. And I'm like, come on. Like, Dave Grohl wrote this essay about like the return, what it's going to be like when live concerts return. And I'm like, God dang it. Like, stop. Like, you got your music, man. You're a rock star. You don't need to come over and like get on our turf and write awesome things and then make everybody realize that like all we're doing is dorking around trying to string letters together, and we can't do it as well as guys who play baseball and electric guitar. That point aside,
drums.
Yeah. Well, whatever. He can probably play the electric guitar too.
He does. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. He plays everything. I saw him in concert once. He's epic. He also did that show after he broke his foot, which was he's incredible. Anyway, point aside, no, it was beautiful. And I think what it probably shows is how some of the people within the game have taken these times without the game and that daily, you know, punching of the clock that baseball requires to kind of stick their head up and go, man, what has become normal for our game doesn't seem right always. And this is baseball being an example of America. And it is going to take people putting their heads up from their daily grind and saying, man, this doesn't seem right. And not only does it not seem right, let's talk about why it doesn't seem right. And then beyond that, let's find something we can do to make things better. And so I applaud him. I think what he's saying is going to reverberate around the game. I hope that the people who need to hear it and everyone is listening. And for the people who don't like to see a player speaking out or don't like to shut up because they have a right to. And if you don't want to listen to it or don't read it, you don't have to. But you're not going to get these guys to stand down. And I hope they don't.
I actually think Ian Desmond did a really good job of touching on something that has become something of a theme, you know, through this whole stretch of time where we've continued to do this podcast and continue to write, but particularly in the conversations that I've had on the podcast about baseball's place in all this and the difference between capital B baseball and little B baseball. And Ian Desmond does a really good job of describing how little B baseball can be part of the American tapestry and where people want it to go and how they want it to recover from tandem national crises. And he's asking whether or not, or he's declaring where capital B baseball fits into it for him. and that if given the choice, he wants to go and see where the game can take him and where he can help the game at a lesser level. But I don't think that it actually at all undermines the importance of Capital B baseball coming back. If anything, it says, look, you know, Capital B baseball can have a part in this reopening, can have a part in the revitalization and the healing and health of the country, but it can't do so without understanding Little B baseball and its influence there. And I thought Desmond took that step and really, really built that bridge with his description of the role. If Capital B baseball is coming back, it has to also not just return to its fields. It's got to stay and return to the fields of where the kids grow up learning it.
Yeah. And who better need of reading that message than Rob Manfred, right?
Right.
That's, you know, that kind of brings us full circle here. Is hopefully this was, I don't know if Rob's on Instagram, but hopefully this was printed out and sent to him, because I think if the conversations that led to this attempted return cared a little more about what you have adequately and appropriately named Little B baseball, then it would have gone differently. And they could have been hard conversations and there could have been disagreements, but the tone would have been different. And I think baseball, and it's unfair to just put it on baseball. It's America. It has to look at some of these things, and beyond the coronavirus discussions, we're having an increased amount of conversations, rightfully so, about a lot of things in our country, a lot of issues. And, you know, and one of the things that Desmond touches on is something that baseball needs to look at, corporate America, everybody. And, you know, and candidly, including journalism, including, you know, Absolutely. Our newspaper, we've got to be mindful about the voices that we lack, and we've got to be mindful about, you know, not using our world experiences as everyone's. So the more reminders we have of that, the more voices being listened to and appreciated, then the better off we're going to be. So, you know, and one thing too is I've already seen this some with, like, you know, Mike Leake opting out and Ryan Zimmerman and now Desmond. We're hearing this, oh, well, these are guys who are, you know, toward the end of their careers or whatever. Okay, these guys would have been valuable baseball players this year. But it's not, let's not pretend like it's not, you know, unusual for guys in any career, men and women, to start to have different thoughts toward, you know, the maturation of their career. Things that maybe seem as so important to us when we're, you know, 22, 26, 28 are a little different when you're, as Ian Desmond, 33, 34, when you've got kids, when you've got a family that you're thinking about. So these, our views and our capacity for understanding things shift over time. So it's not surprising to me to see kind of the phase that some of these guys who are opting out are in their careers.
I mean, it has for me. I mean, I just have a different I have a perspective shaped by the events that we've lived through.
I think everybody should. And if you don't, then you need to ask yourself why. And I think what we should have is a more, you know, more compassionate and understanding society. And that my hope is always that, you know, through massively terrible things, that so there can be some good that comes out of it. And if you can't believe in that, then it gets pretty dark pretty quick. So that's what I'm hoping. And you know, baseball is going to be an example of that. So baseball is, you know, it's funny. We've talked about this with the labor dispute too, is baseball likes the romantic idea of America's pastime and America's game. But, you know, especially when the underbelly shows, it is America's game then too. It doesn't get to pick and choose. And the examples are as true when things are not good as they are when things are great.
Well said, Ben. That's Ben Fredrickson, sports columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and STLtoday.com. You can find his coverage along with all of our Constant Cardinals coverage, including the upcoming coverage of Cardinals summer camp at Busch Stadium. 21 days to prepare for a season that will start on July 23rd or 24th, and then all be kind of clustered in this geographic location. The Post-Dispatch will bring you coverage of it all. Ongoing coverage from, you know, at the ballpark, live coverage on STLtoday.com, and, you know, comprehensive exclusive coverage in the pages of the Post-Dispatch and on stltoday.com. And the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Clauses by Design, will continue as well. We'll be there all along, Ben and I, definitely in the press box at home games, at a suitable and physically distant spacing. But we'll still have conversations and we'll still bring them to you here at BPIB. Get organized by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN. Closet by Design, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. You can find BPIB anywhere you get your podcast, including iTunes. If you go by iTunes, you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes, or you can subscribe to the podcast. Subscriptions make sponsorships like Closet by Design possible, and sponsorships make the weekly podcast possible. Also, during this time, I've learned how to take the podcast on the road, Ben. I can do remote recording. I've taught myself all kinds of crazy things. Then the community that is around BPIB has got to live through my learning curve. So that's good. So we'll continue to do that. Ben, I'm looking forward to seeing you at the ballpark.
Yeah, man. I'll have my new mask.
Yes, so will I.
Can I say one thing here?
Yeah.
Cardinals, free idea. Take this and use it. Why has there not been a Yadier Molina wear a mask St. Louis PSA campaign? Hello?
I don't have an answer for that.
It's a layup.
Yeah, absolutely. They could give away masks printed with the look of his catcher's mask.
I mean, come on, guys. Let's go.
That's a good idea.
They didn't take my idea for the Marcell Ozuna green sleeve giveaway. Missed opportunity. Atlanta should do it. Cardinals need to start selling the Yadi masks, donating the money to charity, also giving them out to youth in the community too. Especially if the kids are going to be going back to school this fall and need masks. This is a great idea. I'm giving it. I gave you a great line. I'll give this to the Cardinals. I'm in a generous mood today.
You're always in a generous mood. And
talk to me after this chat that I'm about to do. I might not be so happy.
Yeah. All right. While Ben gets ready for the chat, I'll get ready to edit this podcast and post it. Thank you all for joining us. As always, thank everyone for joining us through these months without baseball games, but there was still plenty to talk about with baseball. Hope we were a part. And thank you for allowing us to continue this podcast. We look forward to doing it when there's games to be discussed as well. Thanks again, Ben. Hope everybody stays healthy, stays informed. For the best podcast in baseball, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you next week. Actually, talk to you this week. We'll do two this week. What kind of mask did you get?
A couple. I got one of them is like a bluish one. I got a big head. So like this little mask, like it's not good. So I had to like actually do some research and see which ones are like better for people with like insanely sized heads.
I was wondering about like what kind of mask.
I figured you were going to go Spider-Man for sure. I would have bet that you would have had like a Spider-Man mask.
I'm going to disappoint you.
I went with more neutral. I felt like maybe it, I don't know. I should have done something bolder, but I went pretty tame. I am interested to see Rick's though. Rick is going to have like, you know, Rick is like the best dressed person in any press box and he's got such an array of colors. So I figured he'll probably have color coordinated masks.
Absolutely. Yeah. He has the best fashion palette of us all.
It's very, he's the man of many colors.